Blog Talk Radio.
Gonna tell you a little bedtime tale, legend it will become. Burgers flying out the door, sail on. 2-for-1, no concern for the future, living for today. Fast food bite on your way, lay it all to waste. The masses are afflicted now. Moo, mad cow, mad cow. Mad cow line dance song.
Hey, Sign Guy Nation, welcome to the show here on another Friday. Real fast before we jump into things today, if you're looking for wrestling in the next couple of days, tonight, WCWO in Indianapolis, Indiana, like usual. WTF in Carmel, Indiana tonight. Championship Wrestling USA in Gladeville, Tennessee. Tomorrow night you have Cascade Championship Wrestling in Spokane, Washington. Lucha Libre Portland in Gresham, Oregon. Emerge Wrestling in Columbus, Indiana. And BWF in Appomattox, Virginia. Without further ado, though, I want to welcome our guest with us today. He is second-generation professional wrestler, Kurt Beyer. Welcome to the program today.
Oh, it's great to be here, Jason. Thanks for inviting me.
We always ask the people on the show for the first time how they got into the business. We know that you are second-generation. But what sparked your desire to get into the wrestling business?
Well, let's see. I was born in this business. So I grew up in the locker rooms. My earliest memories of childhood are, you know, hanging out in the locker room with the likes of Freddie Blassie and Sky Lolo and Pampero Furpo and, you know, all kinds of characters from my dad's past. I've always been in and around wrestling. It didn't occur to me to actually enter the ring until later on in life, though. I was always 6'4". I was born 6'4", but most of my life I was super skinny. I didn't have any real weight on me, not until I got into my senior years of high school. Then I started wrestling in high school. I went to high school in Japan. So I went to an international school in Japan while my dad was wrestling for All Japan Pro Wrestling there, and he was involved with all of the Japanese media projects at that time. So I went to junior high and high school in Tokyo. And we have our big sports tournaments involve all of the other international schools and base U.S. military schools in Japan, Guam, Philippines, Korea, Hong Kong. What would be equivalent to states in most places is the Far East, what we call the Far East tournament in Japan. So my senior year, I won the Far East tournament for wrestling. And then I went to university. I didn't really pursue it. After university, I was working in Japan. And, you know, you hit that late spot in life and you still haven't fulfilled any of your childhood dreams, and I'll be flat out honest. I wanted to be a rock star. I played drums and guitar. I wanted to be a pilot, and I wanted to be a pro wrestler. If you ask 10-year-old Kurt, you know, what he wanted to be when he grew up, depending on what given day, it would be pilot, rock star, or pro wrestler. One of those three answers is going to come out of my mouth. And I was, you know, talking to one of my young cousins and giving them, you can be the anything you can be in life speech at one point, and she asked me, well, are you doing what you wanted to do in life? And at that time, I was still working for the advertising industry in Japan. I was working in the corporate world in Japan. And so I thought long and hard about it, and Rockstar was out. I play guitar and I sing, but I don't think I could get anybody to pay me to sing, so Rockstar's out. And it was too late for me to go to flight school to be pilot. And I really, really, really thought long and hard about it. And I called my dad from Japan. I told him that I wanted to quit my job and go into pro wrestling. At that time, I was in my mid to late 20s, I was making, in those days, $100,000 a year or so in Japan. And so when I called my dad and told him I wanted to be a pro wrestler, he just said, "You're nuts," and hung up on me. I didn't expect that from him. I was expecting, you know, a different response. You know, you have that scene that you play out in your head and the scene that actually happens. There were two different scenes. The scene in my head was my dad going, "Oh, my son, you know, I've been waiting so many years for you to tell me this, that you wanted to be a pro wrestler. I'm ready to train you, you know, teach you all of my secrets." But instead, he just hung up on me, told me I was an idiot. And I thought long and hard about it some more. And he came over for his August tour. At that time, he was just doing the summer action series in Japan, and said, "No, I'm serious about this. I got to do this. It's something I've wanted to do since I was a kid, and I want to follow through with it." So he said, "Okay," you know. And I left Japan and came back to the States and started training at the Destroyer Pro Wrestling Academy.
When you get into professional wrestling, obviously you're going to have a bit of an advantage being second generation as opposed to other wrestlers coming into it that don't have the ties to the business that you do. When you start wrestling, do you think you were better prepared than other rookies or other wrestlers that had maybe even up to 5 years experience just from being the son of the Destroyer, or do you think that in a lot of ways that worked against you?
Well, it's that's a really great question, Jason. It depends on where I was. For a while, when I went over to wrestle in Germany for Otto Wanz, the fact that I was a Destroyer's son helped me. He gave me a big push, gave me a big match over there. Unfortunately, it was a dismal match. Anybody who saw it will tell you the same, and I'll be the first to admit it, that it was a horrible match after a week's worth of hype and was going to be my big first big push outside of Japan against Franz Schumann at Otto Wanz's territory. And it just was a horrible match. And I claim 50% of the responsibility for that horrible match, and I put 50% of the blame on my partner that day, or my opponent that day. So it was the both of us led to a dismal match. But the fact is that Otto did give me a big push. In Japan, it worked against me big time. It would have been better for me to have just been some nobody off the street. If I was a nobody off the street coming into All Japan Pro Wrestling's dojo, I would have been treated better than I was treated at All Japan's dojo. Anybody going through it, don't misunderstand me. Anybody who's going to go through All Japan's dojo is going to go through a nightmare. The guys that have gone through it, there's only been a few gaijins that have gone through it. Richard Slinger's one of them. Moss Man's one of them. You know, in a Mauna Kea, you know, he came right after me, and Richard Slinger was right before me, and you know, there's some other sort of gaijin sort of different circumstances before that, but the main ones were, you know, what I call real gaijin, where you're really starting off sweeping the floors and scrubbing the mats and that sort of thing. You know, it's miserable. You're going to do, as a warm-up, you're going to do 1,000 sit-ups, 1,200, 1,600 sit-ups. You know, we did probably between leg raises, crunches, and sit-ups, we probably did 1,600 every single day. Push-ups, we probably did well north of 1,000. I'd say easily 1,200 push-ups in the course of a day. Back raises, you know, where you're it's like a reverse sit-up off the ring where you're doing back raises. There's like 500 or 600 of those. And that's just a warm-up to practice. Now, you're not doing 1,600 in a row. You're doing sets of 100, 150, you know, push-ups. You're doing like 20 sets of 20, like with your feet on a chair and your hands on blocks. You're going to do 20 sets of 20. Then you're going to do another, you know, couple hundred over here. You're going to do another couple hundred over there. And it all adds up. You know, you're going to do north of 1,000 push-ups every day. And then practice starts. Then it's bump practice. We'll do anywhere between 400 and 800 bumps in a day. We'll do 100 body slams in a row as a matter of course throughout the day. You know, we spar. That was brutal for me at the beginning, sparring with shoot wrestling, what we call submission wrestling or tap out. I wasn't prepared for that. You know, I had a fairly strong amateur background, and I had a lifetime of pro wrestling moves and holds and things like that, but I wasn't prepared for a tap out, and it was just a sparring thing that we did amongst ourselves. And if you lost, you stayed on the mat. You only got to rest if you won. So for the first couple months, I was getting my butt kicked pretty bad. And you dig deep. They'll keep coming at you. You know, you'll dig deep after the third or fourth match in a row on a brutally hot summer day where it's like 100 degrees, 100% humidity in the dojo, and you can't breathe, and these guys aren't letting up on you. You'll dig deep and turn and grab onto something and twist it hard enough to get them to tap out. And I was lucky that my dojo sensei was Kobashi, Kenta Kobashi. He was, you know, he wasn't a sadist like some of the other nightmares that preceded him. He was, you know, he did all of the exercises with us. He did every push-up with us, every sit-up, every back raiser, you know, the body slams. He was the one giving the body slams. Sparring, he'd be right in there. You know, it's a whole nightmare of exercises that goes on all day. After that, you know, you go on a, you know, 3 or 4 mile run, and then there's hill sprints, and then there's 500 squats. There's a whole litany of things every single day. And I'm not a religious man, but I prayed every day behind the dojo, every single day, to just get me through the day. That's all I prayed for, just get me through the day. And every single day, somebody will cry and somebody will throw up. And if nobody cries, nobody throws up, then they just turn it up a notch for the next day. And this goes on day after day after day, week after week, month after month. And, you know, you eventually, nobody can do 1,600 sit-ups. Nobody can do 1,000 push-ups when they first walk in. But you have to be able to do it until total muscle failure. You can't give up. You have to, if all you can do is squeeze out two more, then that's what you do. You squeeze out two more. When you're up again and you can only do one more, then by golly, you better get down and do one more. You know, we had one guy that walked in, had great physique. You know, very first day, we get to 20 sets of 20 off the blocks of push-ups, and halfway through, he goes, okay, I'm done. I can't do anymore. And he had just done 20. You know, he did the previous set. He had just done 20, and Kobashi was like, well, clearly you can do more. You just did 20. You know, do whatever you can. You know, you know, and he just refused to do any more. So Kobashi gave him ultimatum. Well, this is it. You know, you can do more push-ups, or you can walk out that door. And that guy chose to walk out the door. Moved from the country. Moved from Kyushu up to Honshu. Like, moved from one of the southern islands up to Tokyo. Moved into the dojo. And then didn't want to do any more push-ups and decided, no, I'm going to leave. I saw a dozen of those guys walk into that dojo after me. But from the dojo, in the dojo, everybody's the same. I'm the same as everybody else. But outside of that dojo, as I'm going through the process of working my way up through the ranks, it would have been better for me to have been just some regular guy, because it would have given me a bigger push. I was clearly bigger than everybody. I was stronger. I wasn't the best wrestler at the beginning. Nobody is. I was getting better. You know, Akiyama, they started with a huge push. Izumida, they started with a huge push. Even Omori got a bigger push when he debuted. All those guys debuted before me. Now, they were all in the dojo before me, so they rightly all debuted before me. We all worked out in the dojo for months. And this is after a year in the States with my dad. So I've already gone through a year in the States at the Destroyer Wrestling Academy. And then, you know, I'd gone to Florida, worked out with the Malenkos for several weeks. Then I was on a plane to Japan to go into their dojo. I was supposed to go to Oregon. Don Owen had me and a local Buffalo football star named Blake Bednarz. Blake was a starting guard for Syracuse University, graduated from Syracuse, played a season with the Buffalo Bills, got injured, got out, and Blake and I went through the Destroyer Wrestling Academy together, and Blake and I were supposed to go to Oregon for Don Owen to be his new heels. And that's where my path was supposed to take me. I was supposed to get to Japan through Oregon. Oregon was where I was going to wrestle and hone my skills and get better at, you know, you can, like Dad says, you can teach somebody the moves, you can teach them how to do, you can train them, but you don't really know how to become a wrestler until you're in front of people, until you're in front of a crowd and you know, how to get people, you know, fired up to what you're doing out there. Because if nobody's fired up to what you're doing out there, nobody's going to come and see you. Nobody's coming to see you, nobody's going to hire you. So that's, you know, that's something that you learn while you're on the job. It's kind of like being a musician. Yeah, you could play guitar and sing, but, you know, or being anything that involves people coming to see you. You need to hone your skills. And that's where I was going to, and Don Owen was prepared to teach me that. Don Owen knew I was coming in green, and he was prepared to start us off and teach us right the way he taught my dad decades before. And unfortunately, the WWF, Vince McMahon, dumped his tapes in the territory, and like he did systematically across the country, put Don Owen out of business. You know, I, in my opinion, I think it was an illegal way to put somebody out of business. I think if it was the widget industry, he would have been brought up on antitrust charges. You know, you have antitrust charges. In other words, you can't dump your product in a territory at a low price for the specific purpose of driving the competition out. That's called that we have laws against that in every industry. But in the pro wrestling industry, I think that, you know, it people went, oh, it's pro wrestling. You know, it's for unintelligent people. Like, it's the, really, it's a billion-dollar industry. You know, it's not for unintelligent people. The top 10 shows, four of the top 10 shows are pro wrestling. This is a major, major industry. And that ignorance on the part of our government sort of handed Vince McMahon a billion-dollar industry on a silver platter. At that time, there was a WCW as well. So you could say that between the WCW and WWF, they had sort of an oligopoly on the market. And the two companies sort of controlled the market. But there was a WWF that systematically put all of these former promotions out of business by going into the territory and giving them their TV show. Remember the Saturday afternoon TV shows? You know, with some juiced-up WWF wrestler wrestling some jobber that nobody had ever heard of, 90-second squash match. The announcers aren't even talking about the match that's in the ring. They're talking about upcoming pay-per-view and products and merchandise. It was just a one-hour infomercial. From a business perspective, I think it was brilliant. You know, I have to give it to them, you know. But from an ethical perspective, it was very unethical, I think, the way it was handled. And so the market, like in Oregon, the TV stations got their were able to satisfy their market demand for professional wrestling content. They didn't have to pay for it. And Vince McMahon even packaged it so they had commercial space, and whatever the TV sold for commercials, it was up to them. So basically they got their pro wrestling content for free. What they didn't realize at the time was if you watched the match, all you were getting was an infomercial. It was a pro wrestling infomercial for upcoming pay-per-view because that's all they were talking about. And that's what Vince realized he was making his real money was on the pay-per-views. Those, you know, monthly pay-per-views where he's making millions and millions of dollars every month was a hard thing to ignore for him, I'm sure. But that's how Don Owen got put out of business, and it was right before I was supposed to go out there. So I was left with no other option but to go to Japan and go into their dojo and go through that hell.
We know that in professional wrestling, if you're in it for very long, injuries are part of being a professional wrestler. It's just the nature of the beast. I'm sure that you had the occasional injury pop up during the course of your career. What were some of the injuries that you had to overcome?
That's a really good question too. My dad often credited his long career because he was lucky enough to remain relatively injury free. I mean, he had injuries along the way, but he was always able to overcome them and keep going. He didn't have any permanent injuries that drove him out. For me, I didn't have any real big injuries as I was going through. I had the incidental injuries, you know, the ruptured nose, the split lips, all of that sort of thing that you just have to wrestle through. Unfortunately for me, towards the end, ultimately for me, what killed my career was an injury. I did a goofy move off the top rope with Omori in Japan, and he landed right on my right shoulder and tore the heck out of my rotator cuff. It was just garbage after that. And you can't take time off at All Japan. You know, you wrestle no matter what. So, you know, you don't go, gee, I'm injured. I have to go on the injured reserve list. There is no such thing. You know, you're on the job, and so they don't understand it. And there's a case for, you know, people talking about, you know, they want state-run Medicare and national healthcare system. I lived in a country, Japan, that had a national healthcare system for 20 years, and let me tell you, flat out, it sucks. It sucks so bad. People don't realize it sucks until you're living there and you need something like a shoulder surgery or something along those lines, and you need the expertise and the level of care that you would get in the state. So I had to wait till I got back to the States to have a doctor look at it and let me know what my options were. At the meantime, I had to continue wrestling with a torn rotator cuff in El Japan. And it's the right shoulder, right? And we work the right hand. Lucha Libre and all those guys that work the left, we work the right, right? I mean, we work the left hand, the Lucha Libre works the right, right? So I kept telling guys, you better start working my right shoulder, because no matter what you do in the ring, I'm going to be grabbing my right shoulder because I'm in so much pain. If you're working my leg, I'm going to grab my right shoulder. If you're working my left arm, I'm going to grab my right shoulder. So you might as well work the right shoulder. And fortunately for me, you know, on the tour of that, especially around that time, there was a bunch of guys that did a lot of time down in Mexico and Puerto Rico, so they had no problem just switching to the left to the right. Some wrestlers can't make that switch that quick. They can't just stop working the left and turn to work the right. Guys like the Fantastics, the Malenkos, those guys were all able to, you know, Tommy Rogers and who's Tommy Rogers' partner?
Bobby Fulton.
Bobby was freaking amazing. Bobby was great. So Bobby and Tommy, I wrestled them a lot. You know, the Malenkos, like I said, those guys, all those guys that were doing the southern, you know, south of the border time, they all were able to switch over to the right. So in addition to having the really bad rotator cuff, I got to the point where I couldn't even, standing on the street, point down the street to tell the boys where the hotel was one night. One of the guys said, hey, where's the hotel? And I went to point down the street and say, it's right down there. And I couldn't lift my right arm at all. And so getting in the ring, it was really hard. And you have to fight through it. So I got back to the States. My options were surgery and then about 2 years of rehabilitation, or no surgery and rehabilitation was going to take about 2 years. As it was, I needed to take at least a year off. I couldn't wrestle on it. I couldn't lift. I couldn't do anything. And by that time, Giant Baba passed away, and the groups in Japan started to splinter and separate, and, you know, I was left standing there with really nowhere to go. All of a sudden, by the time I was ready to go, everything had changed, and everything had splintered and separated so bad, and the money was gone. Most importantly, the money was gone. The boys weren't able to go over. There wasn't one big group. There was All Japan and New Japan, and you could go over, and you know you made between $3,000 and $5,000 a week when you were on those tours. You know, at the lowest end, wrestlers are making maybe $2,500 a week. But now, if you make $2,500 a week now in Japan, you're making good money. You know, they're not selling out. All Japan, a small house for All Japan is 4,000 people. That was a small house. You know, that would be out in the country somewhere, you know, 3,000-4,000 people. You know, come back, or Korakuen. Korakuen was always a small house, but Korakuen is special, right? I think Korakuen only seats 2,500 people. But that's a special case because that's always for TV. But a small house in those days was, you know, a few thousand people. Now I'm looking at numbers coming out of Japan. It's a couple hundred here, a couple hundred there. It's reminiscent of, I mean, it looks kind of like, you know, what our independent world looks like here. And thank God for the independence, but, you know, you need some of them to start looking at it from a business and building up. You know, I don't know where AEW came from, but that sure is a step in the right direction. Sorry, that's a tangent, ultimately for me, it was an injury that killed my career, and it was a shoulder injury. And it's, you know, I never actually did get it surgically repaired, so I've just sort of worked around it. I just re-injured it about 6 weeks ago. So sort of chronic thing now. So yeah, for me, ultimately it was an injury that ended my career.
We know that one of the things that a lot of wrestlers, be they former wrestlers who have retired or current wrestlers, look forward to every year is the Cauliflower Alley Club meeting in Las Vegas. Cauliflower Alley has grown and is in sort of a resurgence in popularity with a lot of the wrestlers. Brian Blair is the president, and he's put a lot of work into the organization.
Yeah.
What does the CAC mean to you personally as someone that has gone to the CAC?
Well, I can tell you flat out that the Cauliflower Alley Club is one of the greatest events / Hall of Fame awards that you can get in this industry. I think an award from the Cauliflower Alley Club means more in my eyes than anything the WWF or WWE could give out. It means much more because it's coming from the boys and it's not coming from the company. The Cauliflower Alley Club was started years ago. There was an old wrestler. I don't know how much of the history you know, but there's a wrestler who became an actor, a pro wrestler named Mike Mazurki, and he became one of the first big tough guys from the wrestling world to make it in Hollywood. He's in one of my all-time favorite movies. In fact, it's my favorite John Wayne movie. It's a movie called Donovan's Reef. Takes place on the South Pacific Island after the war. John Wayne and Lee Marvin are on some South Pacific Island, and they you know, shenanigans ensue, right? And the local police constable is the Mike Mazurki, and his cauliflower ear is the ear that they use for the logo for the Cauliflower Alley Club. So it was originally started as a club, an award for professional wrestlers and boxers and actors who have portrayed a wrestler or a boxer on screen. So people like, you know, Sylvester Stallone and those guys, you know, way back in the day were members. And the Cauliflower Alley Club banquet every year was held in Hollywood or in Burbank. You know, it was there every year. And gradually it's shifted. So the boxing element sort of got left behind, and actors who have portrayed wrestlers or boxers, that component of the award sort of got forgotten, and what's left is the professional wrestling aspect, both the women's and men's professional wrestling aspect of this business. And it's endured decades. It goes back to the 50s. It's something that my dad loved, the Cauliflower Alley. Of all the different pro wrestling events throughout the year, the one that he looked forward to most every year is the Cauliflower Alley Club. And it's gone under, you know, different presidents, and different teams have run it, and every single one of those teams have worked close with Dad, and Dad's, you know, Brian Blair is doing an unbelievably great job. And so this is the best opportunity, I think, for wrestlers, especially younger wrestlers or even younger and older wrestlers. You know, every now and then you just want to You want to hang out and you want to meet with kindred spirits. You want to meet with people who see things the way you see things and felt things the way you felt and know a little bit about the hardship or share the same kind of dreams. You know, every now and then you want to hang out with people that think like you. And there isn't anything wrong with that. Every sport, every industry has awards like that. And the Cauliflower Alley Club is just one of those fantastic awards. And a number of years ago, they moved it from California to Las Vegas. And I remember when they did that, I thought, what are they going to do? Just a fighting change just for the sake of fighting change. I thought it was going to be a disaster. You know, who the hell wants to go to Las Vegas? It's Hollywood. It's about being, this is tradition. This is where it's always been. And they found a great home at the Gold Coast. It's just a perfect place to hold it. It's not too big. It's not too small. It's just right. The banquet hall holds everybody just right. Everybody's in there. The prices to stay there are reasonable. Everybody can afford to stay there, or if not, they're very close by without any real hardship. It doesn't cost a lot to eat and drink in and around that compared to other places that's right on the Strip. And the Gold Coast is only one block off the Strip. You go right next door to the Rio, and prices are three times everything they are at the Gold Coast. And the Gold Coast is nice and clean and beautiful. I love that place. And between the Baloney Blowout, which is the first night, is a more informal, and everybody has a chance to tell stories. And I love it when they pass the mic around. And you get to hear stories from people, stories about things that happen on the road or incidental anecdotes that, you know, people just bring up just a story just for the sake of telling a story. And, you know, that used to be a little bit more informal. Now, because of the awards and extended awards, that first night, the Baloney Blowout, is also used for some of the awards presentations, and we've lost a little bit of that casualness open mic. Originally, the Baloney Blowout was, you know, everybody just jeans and a T-shirt, hang out upstairs, drink some beers, literally just eat sandwiches and talk stories. You know, that's what that was all about. Wrestlers love to talk. Right? I don't know a wrestler who doesn't like to talk. So they all love to talk, and they all love to tell stories. You know, it's like the old adage, right? Telephone, telegraph, tell a wrestler, because the word will get around, and they love to tell stories. And the Cauliflower Alley Club is one of the greatest collections of stories that you'll ever hear. And for me, watching my dad have to see every single one of his friends go before him. Every single one of my dad's friends passed away before my dad, all of his closest, his inner circle, to the point where my dad was the last one standing of his generation from that awards. It even breaks me up now. You know, it's hard to see when your dad, you know, he's looking forward to seeing his friends, and, you know, year after year, there's fewer and fewer of his friends. Now, he still maintained a lot of close friends that always support the Cauliflower Alley Club. You know, guys like Dan Westbrook and everybody. Those guys will all come out. Mike Tenay, these guys will all come out, and the historians, you know, that of our inner circle friends of dad's, and then make up our table every year. You know, those friends are all there, but the wrestlers, the guys that dad went through the trenches with, you know, they all disappeared. And now you got a new generation of wrestlers that are there and coming every year, you know, and someday those guys are going to be 60, 70, 80 years old, and same thing going to be happening to them. I love that the Cauliflower Alley Club is continuing. It looks like it's healthy and it's going to continue on for a long, long time. And, you know, God bless everybody that runs that thing. I love it. I look forward to it every year.
At this point in time, my co-host QT Vokes is standing by, and I'm sure he has a few questions as well, so I'm going to pass things over to him for a bit.
Well, thank you, Sign Guy. Hello, Kurt.
Hey, how you doing, brother?
I'm doing very well. Kurt, we're nearing our 10th anniversary of the Turnbuckle Turmoil show. So we've got over 1,400 broadcasts. Yes, pretty close.
Congratulations. That's great to hear. I didn't know that, actually. I'm sorry.
Yes. We even had on B. Brian Blair, and he's one of what I consider one of our top five broadcasts we have ever had in our decade on the air. B. Brian Blair.
That doesn't surprise me. That does not surprise me. Brian Blair is one fantastic individual.
Well, he certainly asked had some good questions for our hard questions. Yes, stood up to our test.
That's great.
Well, Kurt, speaking of the Cauliflower Alley Club and B. Brian Blair, do you consider yourself one of the top five cribbage players at the Cauliflower Alley Club?
I do now. No, I think that, you know, the last cribbage tournament, I won it, right? And it just so happened to be, you know, the sort of a memorial time for Dad. You know, Dad had just passed away. And if I were a betting man, I would bet that the guys that I played put me over. I'm still not convinced that I won that fair and square. I'll go down till the day I die thinking they put me over. I'm grateful that they did, but I still think a couple of the guys put me over.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, how good of a cribbage player is B. Brian Blair?
Oh, well, Brian, I didn't play Brian Blair. I played the other guys. He wasn't in my bracket, so I didn't have to face him. But Brian plays cribbage. I mean, we all grew up. All the old school wrestlers that's the game. That was the game. You played poker or you played cribbage. And when you were on the road, and when I was a little kid, as far back as I can remember, there's been a cribbage board in our house every Christmas, every Thanksgiving, every time we get together. It's, you know, Christmas tournament and cribbage tournament in the house against Dad. Of course, it didn't matter if I beat my brother or my sister. Everybody, we were just happy to beat Dad. So if we beat Dad, that was a huge accomplishment because he was a good cribbage player. All those boys, all the wrestlers, Billy Robinson, you know, go back all in my head, all the guys that played cribbage. I mean, it's like poker. You play poker every day, you're going to be a good poker player. You play poker, you know, once a year with a buddy for pretzels, yeah, you'll know how to play poker, but you're not going to be a great poker player. And I think the old school wrestlers, the older guys, are the guys that are, they got that cribbage skill because they play it a lot. You get better at it the more you play. Any game. I mean, it's true, but especially in cribbage.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, yeah. Kurt, to your knowledge or memory, do you ever remember any wrestler accusing Andre the Giant of cheating in cribbage? Andre the Giant.
You know what? I heard a story, and I can't tell you. I don't remember enough of the particulars to tell you. I heard somebody accused him once, and that was a mistake.
I would think so, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Andre's a pretty straightforward guy. You know, I played cribbage with Andre in Japan. You know, it's funny. Yeah, Andre was on the tour with us on his last tour in Japan, and I was on that tour. And, we're at one of the towns outside of Tokyo. We're about a week into this tour. It's going to be a 4-week tour, and we're like a week or two in, and Andre is sitting in the lobby of the hotel. I've known Andre since I was a little kid. You know, and now that I'm, you know, working my way up through the ranks, I mean, I'm never going to wrestle Andre, but I'm one of the guys that, you know, in the All Japan Pro Wrestling world, I'm one of the guys that escorts him to the ring and back, you know, and takes care of stuff that all the younger guys that are lower on the card, they take care of the guys that are up or higher up on the card. That's just the way it works, right? And, you know, so if you're in one of the, you know, three or four opening matches, as soon as you're done, you go back, you put your All Japan uniform on, and then you take care of the guys that are going into the semi and main events. And so Andre's sitting there, and said, "Are you going to go out to dinner?" And he said, "No, I'm not going." You know, and I said, "Why not?" And then, of course, we all know, right? Andre, he's so big, he couldn't use the toilet. It's the, you know, the toilet's near the wall, right? And Andre's a big guy, so, you know, it doesn't line up, right? The butt doesn't line up because as close as he gets to the wall, he's still pretty wide guy, right? and there isn't any toilet that's just nice there, right there, perfectly in the middle of the room. And Andre, you know, he had to use the bathtub. And, you know, accommodations were made. Everybody knew the hotel would take care of it. But it was always a humiliating thing for Andre. He never, he didn't like having to do that. And he might not have complained openly about it, but to me he did many times. And so he went days without eating any food. And he'd look at the schedule and he'd know that, oh, the day after tomorrow we're going to be in such and such a town, and I know that hotel. That's a good bathroom. I can use that one. And then he wouldn't eat, and he would just drink. He would just drink, and he wouldn't eat. So, and I'm, you know, anybody who knows me, I'm fine. Right, great. Then we don't eat. We'll just drink beer and play cribbage. And so that's what I did. You know, those couple of weeks with Andre, I just, whenever he didn't want to go out, and there wasn't any, I would sit there and drink beer and play cribbage with Andre. And he was a good player. I mean, Andre was damn good, quick too. I mean, you know. We have a family way of, you know, counting cards, and Andrew was just blah, 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 right? You know, and he would tell me stories about, you know, his youth and how he got into wrestling and all the stories. He sat there and told me for 2 weeks everything about, you know, his story, and then I watched a documentary, and it doesn't dovetail to anything that Andre told me out of his mouth.
And oh, wow.
You know, it doesn't have, I don't have anything on record. I only have it in my head, and it's good enough that I have it. You know, I have it in my head. The story that he told me is different than the story that I'm seeing on TV. So that's all I can say. Now, it's not all different, but there's a lot of stuff like, what? No, that's not what he told me.
Oh, okay. That's interesting. Wow. Okay.
Start, you know, how he got started and, you know, leaving his family and then going back to the family and all of that stuff. They're all different. All different. But,
oh,
yeah,
okay.
Andre was he was one of those guys that if he didn't like you, you knew it, you know. But if he liked you, he would take care of you. And Andre he looked out for me when he was there. You know, we would sit there and play cards and just drink massive amounts of beer. Of course, Andre, you know, that's all legendary stuff. I don't need to go into that. No point in trying to match Andre. Just drink your own.
Right.
Just let Andre do whatever he's going to do. Because they're small. You know, those big huge, you've seen those tall beers in Japan, right? The big ones that, you know, they bring to the table. They're about the size of a wine bottle. Well, they look like an OV split when Andre holds on to them, you know. They look like half a beer. So he just threw them, you know. My dad had funny stories about being on the road with Andre. Because when Andre first came to the States, you know, Dad was still wrestling in and around Minnesota, Canada, you know, all that, you know, in between trips to Japan. And so Andre rode with Dad everywhere. Andre would, hey, boss, need beer. And Dad would get a case of beer, and a half hour later, hey, boss, you know, need beer.
Yeah, that's amazing.
But he was a really good guy, really, you know, he's a superstar, a big guy. But he had a very, very, very hard life. Thank God he got into pro wrestling, that he was able to find a career that made him a lot of money, because this world, he would tell me so many times, this world was not made for him. It was not made for him. He couldn't do anything. Drive a car, sit in an airplane, a bus, everything that we take for granted. I complain about economy class seats. You know, Andre couldn't even sit in first class. He had to sit in economy class with the armrests up, because the first class seats were still too narrow for him. And those armrests don't go up in first class. It's like a Barca lounger chair. If you don't fit in it, you don't fit in it. So they would have to put him in economy and flip up all the armrests. So a very uncomfortable way for him to travel. And everything. I mean, going to restaurants, you think about anything that you do on a daily basis that you take for granted, was a source of pain and frustration for him from the time he woke up to the time he went to bed. And even then, they had to build the bed for him every day. They had a team of guys at All Japan that traveled ahead of us, ahead of the bus, and they checked into a hotel to put his bed together, get that bathroom situated, to get everything set up so that he could come in at the end of the day and lie down and go to sleep.
Boy, that I know that wore on him mentally too.
Yeah, that's
rough. That's, yeah, I've heard stories. I've researched, boy. Well, Kurt, have you ever hit a wrestler on the toe with a ringside bell hammer, regardless?
Yeah. Okay. So that's a good story. If you've never heard it, there's a lot of people who already heard it. But my dad was wrestling Mr. Moto. Mr. Moto was a Japanese American wrestler. He also happened to be my dad's best friend, and was the namesake for my sister. Her name is Mona. If my sister had been born a boy, her first name would have been Moto, which is actually a last name in Japanese, but it didn't matter. My dad was going to name, if it was a boy, it was going to be Moto, Moto Buyer. And it was a girl, so they had to scramble, and they named her Mona. And my dad and Mr. Moto, the Destroyer and Mr. Moto, had these legendary matches in L.A. They were great. Mr. Moto, it's too bad that there's not much video of Mr. Moto. He was amazing. Years ago, I saw on YouTube, just by chance, some really great interviews with Jewel Strongbow and Mr. Moto. They're just unbelievable, just awesome, classic, hilarious, on point, so great. And then, you know, and his matches were great and interesting. He was great. It's really a shame that they're gone. If you look for Mr. Moto videos, you get lost in some old Peter Lorre film called Mr. Moto. It interrupted anything. But anyway, Mr. Moto had Dad's mask turned around. And Dad, I was about four. And Dad was, you know, he had cut his head, so he was bleeding. And the mask, you know, that it was always spectacular when Dad cut his head, because the mask soaked up the blood and everything just became red. And Moto had the mask turned around, and I was four, so I started crying, and I tried to climb into the ring to help Dad. And a bunch of guys came and grabbed me, and they dragged me back to the dressing room. And I was kicking and screaming the whole way. When Dad came back to the dressing room after the match, you know, he tried to reason with me. I was 4 years old, but he was like, you know, hey, you know, Kurt, you know, there's no reason for you to worry. You know, I'm okay out there. There's nothing that you need to worry about out there. You know, everything's okay, despite what you see. Don't worry about it. Everything's okay. And the next week, they're wrestling another town like San Bernardino, you know, somewhere in L.A. And same thing, same similar. Moto has Dad's mask turned around. There's blood everywhere again. And Moto didn't wear boots. He always went barefoot, a typical sort of Japanese, you know, sumo style, right? And they couldn't trust me to be on my own, so they had me sitting at ringside with Jerry Murdoch was the referee, and for that match he was the timekeeper. In those days, the timekeeper's table was butt up against the apron of the ring. Now that whole area around the ring is open and there's a cage around it, but in those days the timekeeper's table was right there, and I was sitting at the timekeeper's table because they couldn't trust me to be on my own. And Jerry was just making light of it. He was, in hindsight, he was just trying to, you know, make light of the fact that Dad's right in front of me and he's all bloody and Moto's beating the crap out of him and the mask is turned around and Dad can't see. And Jerry says, Kurt, your dad's in trouble. What are you going to do? And before he could stop me, I jumped up onto the table. I grabbed the hammer from the ring, the bell from the ring, and I came down on Mr. Moto's big toe, like as hard as I could. And I broke it. I mean, ultimately, I broke his toe. And Moto just, I mean, he hollered and screamed. And if there was, I mean, it's too bad there's no video of it. You know, too bad they just overtaped in those days. They didn't think about saving videos for future use. But he, I mean, even 4 years old, I remember everything. There's things that you remember. I remember him just going on and on. And in hindsight, you know, because there was such a huge roar from the crowd, being the pro that he was, he sold it even more than he needed to. You know, of course, Dad, again, doesn't know exactly what's going on because he can't see, right? His mask turned around. And so Moto had to tie up with him to let him know, the referee let him know what had happened. then again, you know, a bunch of guys grabbed me and they dragged me back to the dressing room. And this time Dad came to the dressing room and he was dead serious. He's like, look, like, I can't bring you. I was the only kid who had free reign. I could come and go as I pleased into the dressing room. That was my favorite place when I was a kid. You know, I mean, there's no bad guys are going to be able to get to me at the dressing room. They're going to have to get through all these guys to get to me. You know, it's like Freddie Blassie and even Sky Lolo. I never thought Sky Lolo was a midget. What did I know? I was four. I just thought Sky Lolo was the smartest kid I knew, right? But he was a genius. And all those big wrestlers that were around at the time, you know, they were all there, Mr. Moto, you know, and they're all smoking cigars and playing poker. And, you know, somebody's going to come into that room and hurt me, they'd have to get through all of those guys. You know, it was like, you know, there wasn't a safer place in the world for me. I loved, you know, hanging out in the dressing room. And, you know, Dad was like, look, I can't bring you here. You know, I can't bring you to the matches if you don't get it. You don't understand. I'm okay. You know, that's your Uncle Charlie. You know, that's Mr. Moto. It's your Uncle Charlie, Kurt. You know, you broke his toe, right? And Charlie Moto came out of the dressing room, and I still see it even today. Like, I can tell you how it smelled, the colors, the where the wall is, where the door was. He came out of the dressing room, and he looked at me, and he had that goatee. And he said, Kurt, are you mad at me? And I said, you know, I was mad. Yeah, I was really mad. I was like, yeah, I was still crying. You know, and he goes, okay, you go ahead and pull my beard. And he bent all the way over, brought his chin right in front of me. So I reached up, and I grabbed his goatee, and I pulled on it really hard. And, man, he sold the hell out of it. Oh, Jesus, bounced off the wall, you know, tripped over a chair, you know. He just sold the hell out of it. And even as a four-year-old, I'm looking at him going, that shouldn't have hurt him that bad, right? And he just sold it until he finally looked at me, you know, and he gave me sort of a wink and a nod, like, dude, you get it? Do you get it now? And I did. I was like, wow, I got it. And I was like, holy cow, I get it, right? And he goes, we good now? And I was like, yeah, we're good. Well, don't worry about your daddy. Everything is okay out there. And that was it. I never worried about him again. I swear as God is my witness. It was my uncle, Charlie, Mr. Moto, who smartened me up at 4 years old with one simple question, letting me pull his beard, and that was it. The end of that, all the tears, all the crying, all the tantrums, I finally got it. Like, oh, I get it. I was four.
Very good. Wow. That's a very good story. All right. Well, now, Kurt, have you ever seen the movie Napoleon Dynamite?
I have not seen the movie Napoleon Dynamite, but I hear there's a Dr. X t-shirt in there.
Yes, there is like a... There's a scene where Napoleon Dynamite and his brother Kip try to join the Rex Kwan Dojo. And I was comparing the Rex Kwan Dojo to your All Japan Dojo. Your homework assignment is to watch Napoleon Dynamite on YouTube and look up the Rex Kwan Dojo. And you can report back to Sign Guy which dojo you think would be tougher.
I will. I promise. I will check it out.
Oh, okay. Sign Guy will look forward to that. Okay. All right. Well, at this time, I'm going to pass it back over to Sign Guy. It was very nice talking to you, Kurt.
It was nice talking to you, sir.
Back to you, Sign Guy.
Thank you, QT. Well, Kurt, we got just a few minutes left on the show today, and I want to give you ample time. If there's anything you would like to say to the listeners today, plug and promote anything you would want, floor is all yours.
Well, you know what? There is something I'd like to plug. On the 15th at the Otaku Arena in Tokyo, which is next Friday, HJT Productions in Japan is going to host the first Destroyer Memorial Night at the Otaku Arena. Otaku Arena is pretty close to where Ricky Dozan lived way back in the day. And We're going to have a big night. I can't even tell you how many people are on this card. But from the Gaijin side, I heard Dory Funk Jr. is going to be there with Marty, of course. And I'm looking forward to seeing them. They're two of my favorite people in the world. Stan Hansen is going to be there. Some of the older wrestlers from All Japan. Fuchi is going to be there. I'm looking forward to seeing him. So they're all Wada Akiko, a very famous Japanese singer. She's sort of the Celine Dion of Japan. And she starred in the comedy show with my dad in the 70s. They go back a long way. She's going to make an appearance. It's shaping up to be a pretty big event. So if you're anywhere in Tokyo, next Friday, November 15th, the Otaku Arena is the place to be.
Well, Kurt, I want to thank you very much for taking the time out of your day to be with us here. We enjoyed having you immensely, and hopefully we will get the opportunity one more time down the road.
Anytime you need me. I know you ask me simple questions, and I have a tendency to go off on very long answers. I don't know if I gave you all the answers you needed, but I'm available anytime you want. I enjoyed myself. Like I said, there isn't a wrestler that I know that doesn't like talking about the business.
Absolutely, and we look forward to having you back on the show again, most definitely. Fans, if you're not familiar, jump on your YouTube, check out Kurt Beyer. I think you will enjoy what he did. Definitely, if you're unfamiliar with his father, you should remedy that. He's an absolute legend. So do your homework if you're unfamiliar. We'll be back with you Sunday afternoon. We have Cowboy Scott Casey coming on the show Sunday. Should be an outstanding time then. Get out there, support your local pro wrestling wherever it may be, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.